the lulls, the crows would come and pay them court. But now the birds fled, screeching. They liked the look of that turtle no more than he did. Saturn Horse and the others were looking to him, John knew, waiting for his orders. He was so tired, he hardly knew any more. "The wall is mine," he reminded himself. "Owen, Horse, to the catapults. Kegs, you and Spare Boot on the scorpions. The rest of you string your bows. Fire arrows. Let's see if we can burn it." It was likely to be a futile gesture, John knew, but it had to be better than standing helpless. Cumbersome and slow-moving, the turtle made for an easy shot, and his archers and crossbowmen soon turned it into a lumbering wooden hedgehog. But the wet hides protected it, just as they had the mantlets, and the flaming arrows gutted out almost as soon as they struck. John cursed under his breath. "Scorpions!" he commanded. "Catapults!" The scorpion's bolts punched deep into the pelts, but did no more damage than the fire arrows. The rocks went bouncing off the turtle's roof, leaving dimples in the thick layers of hides. A stone from one of the trebuchets might have crushed it, but the one machine was still broken, and the wildlings had gone wide around the area where the other dropped its loads. "John Estilkirk coming," said Owen the Oaf. He could see that for himself. Inch by inch, yard by yard, the turtle crept closer, rolling, rumbling, and rocking as it crossed the killing ground. Once the wildlings got it flush against the wall, it would give them all the shelter they needed whilst their axes crashed through the hastily repaired outer gates. Inside, under the ice, they would clear the loose rubble from the tunnel in a matter of hours, and then there would be nothing to stop them but two iron gates, a few half-frozen corpses, and whatever brothers John cared to throw in their path to fight and die down in the dark. To his left, the catapult made a thunk and filled the air with spinning stones. They plunked down on the turtle like hail and caromed harmlessly aside. The wilding archers were still loosing arrows from behind their mantlets. One thudded into the face of a straw man, and Pip said, "Four for Wat of Longlake. We have a tie." The next shaft whistled past his own ear, however. "Fie!" he shouted down. "I'm not in the tourney." "The hides won't burn," John said, as much to himself as to the others. Their only hope was to try and crush the turtle when it reached the wall. For that they needed boulders. No matter how stoutly built the turtle was, a huge chunk of rock crashing straight down on top of it from 700 feet was bound to do some damage. "Gren, Owen, Kegs, it's time." Alongside the warming shed, a dozen stout oaken barrels were lined up in a row. They were full of crushed rock, the gravel that the Black Brothers customarily spread on the footpaths to give themselves better footing atop the wall. Yesterday, after he'd seen the free folk covering the turtle with sheepskins, John told Gren to pour water into the barrels, as much as they would take. The water would seep down through the crushed stone, and overnight the whole thing would freeze solid. It was the nearest thing to a boulder they were going to get. "Why do we need to freeze it?" Gren had asked him. "Why don't we just roll the barrels off the way they are?" John answered, "If they crash against the wall on the way down, they'll burst, and loose gravel will spray everywhere. We don't want to rain pebbles on the horses." He put his shoulder to the one barrel with Gren, while Kegs and Owen were wrestling with another. Together they rocked it back and forth to break the grip of the ice that had formed around its bottom. "The bugger weighs a ton," said Gren. "Tip it over and roll it," John said. "Careful. If it rolls over your foot, you'll end up like Spare Boot." Once the barrel was on its side, John grabbed a torch and waved it above the surface of the wall, back and forth, just enough to melt the ice a little. The thin film of water helped the barrel roll more easily. Too easily, in fact. They almost lost it. But finally, with four of them pooling their efforts, they rolled their boulder to the edge and stood it up again. They had four of the big oak barrels lined up above the gate by the time Pip shouted, "There's a turtle at our door!" John braced his injured leg and leaned out for a look. Hoardings. Marsh should have built hoardings. So many things they should have done. The wildlings were dragging the dead giants away from the gate. Horse and Mully were dropping rocks down on them, and John thought he saw one man go down. But the stones were too small to have any effect on the turtle itself. He wondered what the free folk would do about the dead mammoth in the path. But then he saw. The turtle was almost as wide as a longhorn. So they simply pushed it over the carcass. His leg twitched, but Horse caught his arm and drew him back to safety.
"You shouldn't lean out like that," the boy said.
"We should have built hoardings." John thought he could hear the crash of axes on wood, but that was probably just fear ringing in his ears. He looked to Gren.
"Do it!"
Gren got behind a barrel, put his shoulder against it, grunted, and began to push. Owen and Mully moved to help him. They shoved the barrel out a foot, and then another, and suddenly it was gone. They heard the thump as it struck the wall on the way down, and then, much louder, the crash and crack of splintering wood, followed by shouts and screams. Satin whooped, and Owen the Oaf danced in circles, while Pip leaned out and called, "The turtle was stuffed full of rabbits! Look at them hop away!" "Again!" John barked, and Gren and Keggs slammed their shoulders against the next barrel and sent it tottering out into empty air. By the time they were done, the front of Mance's turtle was a crushed and splintered ruin, and wildlings were spilling out the other end and scrambling for their camp. Satin scooped up his crossbow and sent a few quarrels after them as they ran, to see them off the faster. Gren was grinning through his beard, Pip was making japes, and none of them would die today. On the morrow, though, John glanced toward the shed. 8 barrels of gravel remained, where 12 had stood a few moments before. He realized how tired he was then, and how much his wound was hurting. "I need to sleep, a few hours at least." He could go to Maester Aemon for some dream wine, that would help. "I'm going down to the King's Tower," he told them. "Call me if Mance gets up to anything. Pip, you have the wall."
"Me?" said Pip.
"Him?"
said Gren. Smiling, he left them to it and rode down in the cage. A cup of dream wine did help, as it happened. No sooner had he stretched out on the narrow bed in his cell than sleep took him. His dreams were strange and formless, full of strange voices, shouts and cries, and the sound of a war horn blowing low and loud, a single deep booming note that lingered in the air. When he awoke, the sky was black outside the arrow slit that served him for a window, and 4 men he did not know were standing over him. One held a lantern.
"John Snow," the tallest of them said brusquely, "pull on your boots and come with us."
His first groggy thought was that somehow the wall had fallen whilst he'd slept, that Man's raider had sent more giants or another turtle and broken through the gate. But when he rubbed his eyes, he saw that the strangers were all in black. "They're men of the Night's Watch," John realized.
"Come where? Who are you?"
The tall man gestured, and 2 of the others pulled John from the bed. With the lantern leading the way, they marched him from his cell and up a half turn of stair to the old bear's solar. He saw Maester Aemon standing by the fire, his hands folded around the head of a blackthorn cane. Septon Celador was half drunk as usual, and Sir Winton Stout was asleep in a window seat. The other brothers were strangers to him, all but one. Immaculate in his fur-trimmed cloak and polished boots, Sir Alistair Thorne turned to say,
"Here's a turncloak now, my lord. Ned Stark's bastard, a Winterfell."
"I'm no turncloak, Thorne," John said coldly.
"We shall see."
In the leather chair behind the table where the old bear wrote his letters sat a big, broad, jowly man John did not know.
"Yes, we shall see," he said again. "You will not deny that you are John Snow, I hope. Stark's bastard. Lord Snow, he likes to call himself."
Sir Alistair was a spare, slim man, compact and sinewy, and just now his flinty eyes were dark with amusement. "You're the one who named me Lord Snow," said John. Sir Alistair had been fond of naming the boys he trained during his time as Castle Black's master-at-arms. The old bear had sent Thorn to Eastwatch by the sea. These others must be Eastwatch men. The bird reached Cutter Pike, and he sent us help. "How many men have you brought?" he asked the man behind the table.
"It's me who'll ask the questions," the jolly man replied. "You've been charged with oath-breaking, cowardice, and desertion, John Snow. Do you deny that you abandoned your brothers to die on the fist of the first men and joined the wildling Mance Rayder, this self-styled king beyond the wall?"
"Abandoned?" John almost choked on the word. Maester Aemon spoke up then.
"My lord, Donald Noy and I discussed these issues when John Snow first returned to us and were satisfied by John's explanations."
"Well, I am not satisfied, maester," said the jolly man. "I will hear these explanations for myself. Yes, I will."
John swallowed his anger.
"I abandoned no one. I left the Fist with Corrin Halfhand to scout the Skirling Pass. I joined the wildlings under orders. The Halfhand feared that Mance might have found the Horn of Winter."
"The Horn of Winter?" Sir Alistair chuckled. "Were you commanded to count their snarks as well, Lord Snow?"
"No, but I counted their giants as best I could."
"Sir," snapped the jolly man, "you will address Sir Alistair as Sir, and myself as my lord. I am Janus Slint, Lord of Harrenhal, and commander here at Castle Black, until such time as Bourne Marsh returns with his garrison. You will grant us our courtesies, yes? I will not suffer to hear an anointed knight like the good Sir Alistair mocked by a traitor's bastard."
He raised a hand and pointed a meaty finger at John's face.
"Do you deny that you took a wildling woman into your bed?"
"No."
John's grief over Ygritte was too fresh for him to deny her now.
"No, my lord."
"I suppose it was also the Halfhand who commanded you to fuck this unwashed whore?"
Sir Alistair asked with a smirk.
"Sir, she was no whore, sir. The Halfhand told me not to balk whatever the wildlings asked of me, but I will not deny that I went beyond what I had to do, that I cared for her."
"You admit to being an oath-breaker, then?" said Janus Slint.
Half the men at Castle Black visited Molestown from time to time to dig for buried treasure in the brothel, John knew, but he would not dishonour Ygritte by equating her with the Molestown whores. "I broke my vows with a woman. I admit that, yes."
"Yes, my lord."
When Slint scowled, his jowls quivered. He was as broad as the old bear had been, and no doubt would be as bald if he lived to Mormont's age. Half his hair was gone already, though he could not have been more than 40.
"Yes, my lord," John said. "I rode with the wildlings and ate with them, as the Halfhand commanded me, and I shared my furs with Ygritte. But I swear to you, I never turned my cloak. I escaped the Magnar as soon as I could, and never took up arms against my brothers or the realm." Lord Slint's small eyes studied him.
"Sir Glendon," he commanded, "bring in the other prisoner."
Sir Glendon was the tall man who had dragged John from his bed. Four other men went with him when he left the room. But they were back soon enough with a captive, a small, sallow, battered man, fettered hand and foot. He had a single eyebrow, a widow's peak, and a moustache that looked like a smear of dirt on his upper lip. But his face was swollen and mottled with bruises, and most of his front teeth had been knocked out. The Eastwatch men threw the captive roughly to the floor. Lord Slint frowned down on him.
"Is this the one you spoke of?"
The captive blinked yellow eyes.
"Aye."
Not until that instant did John recognize Rattleshirt. "He is a different man without his armor," he thought.
"Aye," the wildling repeated. "He's the Craven,
kill the half hand, up in a frost fang, as it were, after we'd hunted down t'other crows, and killed them, everyone. We would have done for this one, too, only he begged for his worthless life, offered to join us if we'd have him. The half hand swore he'd see the craven dead first, but the wolf ripped Corrin half to pieces, and this one opened his throat.
He gave John a crack-tooth smile then, and spat blood on his foot.
"Well,"
Gina Slint demanded of John harshly,
"do you deny it, or will you claim Corrin commanded you to kill him?"
"He told me," the words came hard, "he told me to do whatever they asked of me."
Slint looked about the solar at the other East Watch men.
"Does this boy think I fell off a turnip wagon onto my head?"
"Your lies won't save you now, Lord Snow," warned Sir Alistair Thorne. "We'll have the truth from you, bastard." "I've told you the truth. Our garrons were failing and Ruttleshirt was close behind us. Corrin told me to pretend to join the wildlings. You must not balk whatever is asked of you," he said. "He knew they would make me kill him. Rattleshirt was going to kill him anyway. He knew that too."
"So now you claim the great Corrin Halfhand feared this creature?"
Slint looked at Rattleshirt and snorted.
"All men fear the Lord of Bounds,"
the wildling grumbled. Sir Glendon kicked him, and he lapsed back into silence. "I never said that," John insisted. Slint slammed a fist on the table.
"I heard you. Sir Alistair had your measure true enough, it seems. You lie through your bastard teeth. Well, I will not suffer it. I will not. You might have fooled this crippled blacksmith, but not Jaina Slint. Oh, no, Jaina Slint does not swallow lies so easily. Do you think my skull was stuffed with cabbage?"
"I don't know what your skull is stuffed with, my lord." "Lord Snow is nothing if not arrogant," said Sir Alistair. "He murdered Corrin just as his fellow turncloaks did Lord Marmont.
It would not surprise me to learn that it was all part of the same fell plot. Benjen Stark may well have had a hand in all this as well. For all we know, he's sitting in Mance Raider's tent even now. You know these Starks, my lord?"
"I do," said Jaina Slint. "I know them too well."
John peeled off his glove and showed them his burned hand. "I burned my hand defending Lord Mormont from a wight, and my uncle was a man of honour. He would never have betrayed his vows."
"No more than you," mocked Sir Alistair.
Septon Celador cleared his throat.
"Lord Slint," he said, "this boy refused to swear his vows properly in the sept, but went beyond the wall to see his words before a heart tree. His father's gods, he said, but they are a wildling gods as well." "They are the gods of the north, Septon," Maester Aemon was courteous but firm. "My lords, when Donald Noy was slain, it was this young man, John Snow, who took the wall and held it against all the fury of the north. He has proved himself valiant, loyal, and resourceful. Were it not for him, you would have found Mance Raider sitting here when you arrived, Lord Slint. You are doing him a great wrong. John Snow was Lord Mormont's own steward and squire. He was chosen for that duty because the Lord Commander saw much promise in him, as do I."
"Promise?"
said Slint.
"Well, promise may turn false. Corrin Halfhand's blood is on his hands. Mormont trusted him, you see. But what of that? I know what it is to be betrayed by men you trusted. Oh, yes. And I know the ways of wolves as well."
He pointed at John's face.
"Your father died a traitor."
"My father was murdered." John was past caring what they did to him. But he would not suffer any more lies about his father. Slint purpled.
"Murder, you insolent pup. King Robert was not even called when Lord Eddard moved against his son."
He rose to his feet, a shorter man than Mormont, but thick about the chest and arms with a gut to match. A small gold spear tipped with red enamel pinned his cloak at the shoulder.
"Your father died by the sword, but he was highborn.
a king's hand. For you, a noose will serve. Sir Alistair, take this turn cloak to an ice cell.
My lord is wise. Sir Alistair seized John by the arm. John yanked away and grabbed the knight by the throat with such ferocity that he lifted him off the floor. He would have throttled him if the East Watch men had not pulled him off. Thorn staggered back, rubbing the marks John's fingers had left on his neck.
You see for yourselves, brothers. The boy is a wildling.
Tyrion.
They of my son,
Tywin Lannister said.
They do, my lord.
The messenger's voice was dulled by exhaustion. On the breast of his torn surcoat, the brindled boar of Crakehall was half obscured by dried blood. One of your sons, Tyrion thought. He took a sip of wine and said not a word, thinking of Jaime. When he lifted his arm, pain shot through his elbow, reminding him of his own brief taste of battle. He loved his brother, but he would not have wanted to be with him in the Whispering Wood for all the gold in Castle Rock. His lord father's assembled captains and bannermen had fallen very quiet as the courier told his tale. The only sound was the crackle and hiss of the log burning in the hearth at the end of the long, draughty common room. After the hardships of the long, relentless drive south, the prospect of even a single night in an inn had cheered Tyrion mightily, though he rather wished it had not been this inn again, with all its memories. His father had set a grueling pace, and it had taken its toll. Men wounded in the battle kept up as best they could, or were abandoned to fend for themselves. Every morning they left a few more by the roadside, men who went to sleep, never to wake. Every afternoon a few more collapsed along the way, and every evening a few more deserted, stealing off into the dusk. Tyrion had been half tempted to go with them. He had been upstairs enjoying the comforts of a feather bed and the warmth of Shay's body beside him, when his squire had woken him to say that a rider had arrived with dire news of Riverrun. So it had all been for nothing. The rush south, the endless forced marches, the bodies left beside the road, all for naught. Robb Stark had reached Riverrun days and days ago.
"How could this happen?"
Sir Harry Swift moaned.
"How? Even after the Whispering Wood you had River Run ringed in iron, surrounded by a great host? What madness made Sir Jaime decide to split his men into three separate camps? Surely he knew how vulnerable that would leave them."
"Better than you, you chinless craven,"
Tyrion thought. Jaime might have lost River Run, but it angered him to hear his brother slandered by the likes of Swift, a shameless lickspittle, whose greatest accomplishment was marrying his equally chinless daughter to Sir Kevin, and thereby attaching himself to the Lannisters.
"I would have done the same," his uncle responded, a good deal more calmly than Tyrion might have.
"You have never seen a river run, Sir Alice, or you would know that Jaime had little choice in the matter. The castle is situated at the end of the point of land where the Tumblestone flows into the Red Fork of the Trident. The rivers form two sides of a triangle, and when danger threatens, the Tullys open their sluice gates upstream to create a wide moat on the third side, turning River Run into an island. The walls rise sheer from the water, and from the towers the defenders have a commanding view of the opposite shores for many leagues around. To cut off all the approaches, a besieger must need place one camp north of the Tumblestone, one south of the Red Fork, and a third between the rivers west of the moat. There is no other way. None."
"Sir Kevin speaks truly, my lords," the courier said. "We'd built palisades of sharpened stakes around the camps, yet it was not enough, not with no warning, and the rivers cutting us off from each other. They came down on the north camp first. No one was expecting an attack.
Mark Piper had been raiding our supply trains, but he had no more than 50 men. So Jamie had gone out to deal with them the night before. Well, with what he thought was them. We were told the Stark host was east of the Green Fork, marching south. And your outriders? Sir Gregor Clegane's face might have been hewn from rock. The fire in the hearth gave a somber orange cast to his skin and put deep shadows in the hollows of his eyes. They saw nothing? They gave you no warning? The blood-stained messenger shook his head. Our outriders had been vanishing. Mark Piper's work, we thought. The ones who did come back had seen nothing. A man who sees nothing has no use for his eyes, the mountain declared. Cut them out and give them to your next outrider. Tell him you hope that four eyes might see better than two, and if not, the man after him will have six.
Lord Tywin Lannister turned his face to study Sir Gregor. Tyrion saw a glimmer of gold as the light shone off his father's pupils, but he could not have said whether the look was one of approval or disgust. Lord Tywin was oft quiet in council, preferring to listen before he spoke, a habit Tyrion himself tried to emulate. Yet this silence was uncharacteristic even for him, and his wine was untouched.
"You say they came at night," Sir Kevin prompted.
The man gave a weary nod.
"The Blackfish led the van, cutting down our sentries and clearing away the palisades for the main assault. By the time our men knew what was happening, riders were pouring over the ditch banks and galloping through the camp with swords and torches in hand. I was sleeping in the west camp between the rivers. When we heard the fighting and saw the tents being fired, Lord Brax led us to the rafts, and we tried to pole across. But the current pushed us downstream, and the Tullys started flinging rocks at us with the catapults on their walls. I saw one raft smashed to kindling, and three others overturned, men swept into the river and drowned. And those who did make it across found the Starks waiting for them on the river bank.
Sir Flemont Brax wore a silver and purple tabard and the look of a man who cannot comprehend what he has just heard.
My lord father.
Sorry, my lord, the messenger said. Lord Brax was clad in plate and mail when his raft overturned. He was very gallant.
He was a fool, Tyrion thought, swirling his cup and staring down into the winy depths.
Crossing a river at night on a crude raft, wearing armour, with an enemy waiting on the other side? If that was gallantry, he would take cowardice every time. He wondered if Lord Brax had felt especially gallant, as the weight of his steel pulled him under the black water.
The camp between the rivers was overrun as well, the messenger was saying. While we were trying to cross, more Starks swept in from the west, two columns of armoured horse. I saw Lord Umber's giant in chains and the Malister Eagle, but it was the boy who led them, with a monstrous wolf running at his side. I wasn't there to see it, but it said the beast killed four men and ripped apart a dozen horses. Our spearmen formed up a shield wall and held against their first charge, but when the Tullys saw them engaged, they opened the gates of River Run, and Titus Blackwood led a sortie across the drawbridge and took them in the rear.
God save us, Lord Lefford swore.
Great John Umber fired the siege towers we were building, and Lord Blackwood found Sir Edmure Tully in chains among the other captives and made off with them all. Our south camp was under the command of Sir Fawley Prester. He retreated in good order when he saw that the other camps were lost, with 2,000 spears and as many bowmen. But the Tyrushy sellsword, who led his free riders, struck his banners and went over to the foe.
Curse the man! His Uncle Kevin sounded more angry than surprised.
I warn Jamie not to trust that one. A man who fights for coin is loyal only to his purse.
Lord Tywin wove his fingers together under his chin. Only his eyes moved as he listened. His bristling, golden side whiskers framed a face so still it might have been a mask. But Tyrion could see tiny beads of sweat dappling his father's shaven head.
How could it happen?
Sir Harry Swift wailed again. Sir Jamie taken, a siege broken. This is a catastrophe. Sir Adam Marbrand said,
I'm sure we're all grateful to you for pointing out the obvious, Sir Harry. The question is, what should we do about it?
What can we do? Jamie's host is all slaughtered, all taken, all put to flight, and the Starks and the Tullys sit squarely across our line of supply. We are cut off from the west. They can march on Castle Rock if they so choose, and what's to stop them? My lords, we are beaten. We must sue for peace.
Peace? Tyrion swirled his wine thoughtfully, took a deep draught, and hurled his empty cup to the floor, where it shattered into a thousand pieces.
There's your peace, Sir Arius. My sweet nephew broke it for good and all when he decided to ornament the Red Keep with Lord Eddard's head. You'll have an easier time drinking wine from that cup than you will convincing Robb Stark to make peace now. He's winning. Or hadn't you noticed?
Two battles do not make a war, Sir Adam insisted. We are far from lost. I should welcome the chance to try my own steel against this dark boy.
Perhaps they would consent to a truce, and allow us to trade our prisoners for theirs, offered Lord Lefford. Unless they trade 3-1, we still come out light on those scales,
Tyrion said acidly.
And what are we to offer for my brother? Lord Eddard's rotting head? I had heard that Queen Cersei has the Hand's daughters, Lefford said hopefully. If we give the lad his sisters back.
Sir Adam snorted disdainfully.
He would have to be an utter ass to trade Jaime Lannister's life for two girls.
Then we must ransom Sir Jaime, whatever it costs, Lord Lefford said.
Tyrion rolled his eyes.
If the Starks feel the need for gold, they can melt down Jaime's armour.
If we ask for truce, they will think us weak, Sir Adam argued. We should march on them at once.
Surely our friends at court could be prevailed upon to join us with fresh troops, said Sir Harry's. And someone might return to Castle Rock to raise a new host.
Lord Tywin Lannister rose to his feet.
They have my son,
he said once more, in a voice that cut through the babble like a sword through suet.
Leave me, all of you.
Ever the soul of obedience, Tyrion rose to depart with the rest. But his father gave him a look.
Not you, Tyrion, remain. And you as well, Kevin. The rest of you, out.
Tyrion eased himself back onto the bench, startled into speechlessness. Sir Kevin crossed the room to the wine casks.
Uncle, Tyrion called, if you would be so kind.
Here. His father offered him his cup, the wine untouched. Now Tyrion truly was nonplussed. He drank. Lord Tywin seated himself.
You have the right of it about Stark. Alive, we might have used Lord Eddard to forge a peace with Winterfell and Riverrun, a peace that would have given us the time we need to deal with Robert's brothers.
Dead?
His hand curled into a fist.
Madness. Rank madness.
Joff's only a boy, Tyrion pointed out. At his age, I committed a few follies of my own.
His father gave him a sharp look.
I suppose we ought to be grateful that he has not yet married a whore.
Tyrion sipped at his wine, wondering how Lord Tywin would look if he flung the cup in his face.
Our position is worse than you know,
his father went on.
It would seem we have a new king.
Sir Kevin looked perplexed.
A new who? What have they done to Joffrey?
The faintest flicker of distaste played across Lord Tywin's thin lips.
Nothing yet. My grandson still sits the Iron Throne, but the eunuch has heard whispers from the south. Renly Baratheon wed Margaery Tyrell at Highgarden this fortnight past. and now he has claimed the crown. The bride's father and brothers have bent the knee and sworn him their swords.
Those are grave tidings. When Sir Kevin frowned, the furrows in his brow grew deep as canyons.
My daughter commands us to ride for King's Landing at once, to defend the Red Keep against King Renly and the Knight of Flowers. His mouth tightened. Commands us, mind you, in the name of the King and Council.
How is King Joffrey taking the news? Tyrion asked, with a certain black amusement.
Cersei has not seen fit to tell him yet, Lord Tywin said. She fears he might insist on marching against Renly himself.
With what army? Tyrion asked. You don't plan to give him this one, I hope.
He talks of leading the city watch, Lord Tywin said.
If he takes the watch, he'll leave the city undefended, Sir Kevin said, and with Lord Stannis on Dragonstone.
Yes, Lord Tywin looked down at his son. I had thought you were the one made for Muttley, Tyrion, but it would appear that I was wrong.
Why, father, said Tyrion, that almost sounds like praise.
He leaned forward intently.
What of Stannis? He's the elder, not Renly. How does he feel about his brother's claim?
His father frowned.
I felt from the beginning that Stannis was a greater danger than all the others combined. Yet he does nothing. Oh, Varys hears his whispers. Stannis is building ships. Stannis is hiring sellswords. Stannis is bringing a shadowbinder from Ashai. What does it mean? Is any of it true?
He gave an irritated shrug.
Kevin, bring us the map.
Sir Kevin did as he was bid. Lord Tywin unrolled the leather, smoothing it flat.
Jaime has left us in a bad way. Roose Bolton and the remnants of his host are north of us. Our enemies hold the Twins and Moat Cailin. Robb Stark sits to the west. So we cannot retreat to Lannisport and the Rock unless we choose to give battle. Jaime is taken, and his army for all purposes has ceased to exist. Thoros of Myr and Beric Dondarrion continue to plague our foraging parties. To the east we have the Aerons. Stannis Baratheon sits on Dragonstone, and in the south Highgarden and Storm's End are calling their banners.
Tyrion smiled crookedly.
Take heart, father. At least Rhaegar Targaryen is still dead.
I had hoped you might have more to offer us than japes, Tyrion,
Lord Tywin Lannister said. Sir Kevin frowned over the map, forehead creasing. Robb Stark will have Edmure Tully and the Lords of the Trident with him now. Their combined power may exceed our own, and with Roose Bolton behind us... Tywin, if we remain here, I fear we might be caught between three armies.
I have no intention of remaining here. We must finish our business with young Lord Stark before Renly Baratheon can march from Highgarden. Bolton does not concern me. He's a wary man, and we made him warier on the Green Fork. He will be slow to give pursuit. So, on the morrow, we make for Harrenhal. Kevin... I want Sir Adam's outriders to screen our movements. Give him as many men as he requires, and send them out in groups of four. I will have no vanishings.
As you say, my lord, but
why Harrenhal? That is a grim, unlucky place. Some call it cursed. Let them,
Lord Tywin said.
Unleash Sir Gregor and send him before us with his reavers. Send forth Vargo Holt and his free riders as well, and Sir Aemory Lorch. Each is to have 300 horse. Tell them I want to see the river rands of fire from the Guard's Eye to the Red Fork.
They will burn, my lord, Sir Kevin said, rising. I shall give the commands. He bowed and made for the door. When they were alone, Lord Tywin glanced at Tyrion.
Your savages might relish a bit of rapine. Tell them they may ride with Vargo Holt and plunder as they like, good stock, women. They may take what they want and burn the rest.
Telling a shagger and timid how to pillage is like telling a rooster how to crow,
Tyrion commented.
But I should prefer to keep them with me.
Uncouth and unruly they might be, yet the wildlings were his, and he trusted them more than any of his father's men. He was not about to hand them over.
Then you had better learn to control them. I will not have the city plundered.
The city?
Tyrion was lost.
What city would that be?
King's Landing. I am sending you to court.
It was the last thing Tyrion Lannister would ever have anticipated. He reached for his wine and considered for a moment as he sipped.
And what am I to do there?
Rule,
his father said curtly. Tyrion hooted with laughter.
My sweet sister might have a word or two to say about that.
Let her say what she likes. Her son needs to be taken in hand before he ruins us all. I blame those jackanapes on the council, our friend Petyr, the venerable Grand Maester, and that cockless wonder, Lord Varys. What sort of counsel are they giving Joffrey when he lurches from one folly to the next? Whose notion was it to make this Janus Slint a lord? Huh? The man's father was a butcher, and they grant him Harrenhal? Harrenhal, that was the seat of kings. Not that he will ever set foot inside it, if I have any say. I'm told he took a bloody spear for his sigil. A bloody cleaver would have been my choice.
His father had not raised his voice, yet Tyrion could see the anger in the gold of his eyes.
And dismissing Selmy, where was the sense in that? Yes, the man was old, but the name of Barristan the Bold still has meaning in the realm. He lent honour to any man he served. Can anyone say the same of the Hound? You feed your dog bones under the table. You do not seat him beside you on the eye bench.
He pointed a finger at Tyrion's face.
If Cersei cannot curb the boy, you must. And if these counsellors are playing us false...
Tyrion knew.
Spikes, he sighed. Heads, walls.
I see that you've taken a few lessons from me.
More than you know, father,
Tyrion answered quietly. He finished his wine and set the cup aside, thoughtful. A part of him was more pleased than he cared to admit. Another part was remembering the battle upriver and wondering if he was being sent to hold the left again.
Why me?
He asked, cocking his head to one side.
Why not my uncle? Why not Sir Adam, or Sir Flemont, or Lord Serret? Why not a bigger man?
Lord Tywin rose abruptly. You are my son.
That was when he knew.
You have given him up for lost, he thought. You bloody bastard. You think Jaime is good as dead. So I'm all you have left.
Tyrion wanted to slap him, to spit in his face, to draw his dagger and cut the heart out of him, and see if it was made of old hard gold, the way the small folk said. Yet he sat there, silent and still. The shards of the broken cup crunched beneath his father's heels as Lord Tywin crossed the room.
One last thing,
he said at the door.
You will not take the whore to court.
Tyrion sat alone in the common room for a long while after his father was gone. Finally, he climbed the steps to his cozy garret beneath the bell tower. The ceiling was low, but that was scarcely a drawback for a dwarf. From the window, he could see the gibbet his father had erected in the yard. The innkeep's body turned slowly on its rope whenever the night wind gusted. Her flesh had grown as thin and ragged as Lannister hopes. She murmured sleepily and rolled toward him when he sat on the edge of the feather bed. He slid his hand under the blanket and cupped a soft breast, and her eyes opened.
My lord,
she said with a drowsy smile. When he felt her nipple stiffen, Tyrion kissed her.
"I have a mind to take you to King's Landing, sweetling," he whispered.
This is Roy Dotrice. We hope you've enjoyed this production of A Clash of Kings, Book 2 of A Song of Ice and Fire by George R. R. Martin. A Clash of Kings, Book 2 of A Song of Ice and Fire. Copyright 1999 by George R. R. Martin. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. Production copyright 2004, Books on Tape Incorporated.
John. The mare whickered softly as John Snow tightened the cinch.
"Easy, sweet lady,"
he said in a soft voice, quieting her with a touch. Wind whispered through the stable, a cold, dead breath on his face, but John paid it no mind. He strapped his roll to the saddle, his scarred fingers stiff and clumsy.
"Ghost," he called softly, "to me."
And the wolf was there, eyes like embers.
"John, please, you must not do this."
He mounted, the reins in his hand, and wheeled the horse round to face the night. Samuel Tarley stood in the stable door, a full moon peering over his shoulder. He threw a giant shadow, immense and black. "Get out of my way, Sam."
"John, you can't," Sam said. "I won't let you."
"I would sooner not hurt you," John told him. "Move aside, Sam, or I'll ride you down."
"You won't. You have to listen to me, please."
John put his spurs to horse flesh, and the mare bolted for the door. For an instant, Sam stood his ground, his face as round and pale as the moon behind him, his mouth a widening O of surprise. At the last moment, when they were almost on him, he jumped aside, as John had known he would, stumbled and fell. The mare leapt over him, out into the night. John raised the hood of his heavy cloak and gave the horse her head. Castle Black was silent and still as he rode out, with Ghost racing at his side. Men watched from the wall behind him, he knew, but their eyes were turned north, not south. No one would see him go. No one but Sam Tarley, struggling back to his feet in the dust of the old stables. He hoped Sam hadn't hurt himself, falling like that. He was so heavy and so ungainly, it would be just like him to break a wrist or twist his ankle getting out of the way.
"I warned him," John said aloud. "It was nothing to do with him, anyway."
He flexed his burned hand as he rode, opening and closing the scarred fingers. They still pained him, but it felt good to have the wrappings off. Moonlight silvered the hills as he followed the twisting ribbon of the King's Road. He needed to get as far from the wall as he could before they realized he was gone. On the morrow he would leave the road and strike out overland, through field and bush and stream, to throw off pursuit, but for the moment speed was more important than deception. It was not as though they would not guess where he was going. The old bear was accustomed to rise at first light, so John had until dawn to put as many leagues as he could between himself and the wall, if Sam Tarley did not betray him. The fat boy was dutiful and easily frightened, but he loved John like a brother. If questioned, Sam would doubtless tell them the truth, but John could not imagine him braving the guards in front of the King's Tower to wake Mormont from sleep. When John did not appear to fetch the old bear's breakfast from the kitchen, they'd look in his cell and find Longclaw on the bed. Been hard to abandon it, but John was not so lost to honour as to take it with him. Even Jorah Mormont had not done that when he fled in disgrace. Doubtless Lord Mormont would find someone more worthy of the blade. John felt bad when he thought of the old man. He knew his desertion would be salt in the still raw wound of his son's disgrace. That seemed a poor way to repay him for his trust, but it couldn't be helped. No matter what he did, John felt as though he were betraying someone. Even now, he did not know if he was doing the honourable thing. The Southron had it easier. They had their septons to talk to, someone to tell them the gods will, and help sort out right from wrong. But the Starks worshipped the old gods, the nameless gods, and if the heart trees heard, they did not speak. When the last lights of Castle Black vanished behind him, John slowed his mare to a walk. He had a long journey ahead, and only the one horse to see him through. There were holdfasts and farming villages along the road south, where he might be able to trade the mare for a fresh mount when he needed one, but not if she were injured or blown. He would need to find new clothes soon. Most like he'd need to steal them. He was clad in black from head to heel. High leather riding boots, rough-spun breeches and tunic, sleeveless leather jerkin, and heavy wool cloak. His long sword and dagger were sheathed in black moleskin, and his hauberk and coif in his saddlebag were black ringmail. Any bit of it could mean his death if he were taken. A stranger wearing black was viewed with cold suspicion in every village and holdfast north of the neck, and men would soon be watching for him. Once Maester Aemon's ravens took flight, John knew he would find no safe haven, not even at Winterfell. Bran might want to let him in, but Maester Luin had better sense. He would bar the gates and send John away, as he should. Better not to call there at all. Yet he saw the castle clear in his mind's eye, as if he had left it only yesterday, the towering granite walls, the great hall, with its smells of smoke and dark and roasting meat, his father Solar, the turret room where he had slept. Part of him wanted nothing so much as to hear Bran laugh again, to sup on one of Gage's beef and bacon pies, to listen to old Nan tell her tales of the children of the forest and Florian the Fool. But he had not left the wall for that. He had left because he was, after all, his father's son and Rob's brother. The gift of a sword, even a sword as fine as Longclaw, did not make him a Mormont. Nor was he Aemon Targaryen. Three times the old man had chosen, and three times he had chosen honour. But that was him. Even now, John could not decide whether the maester had stayed because he was weak and craven, or because he was strong and true. Yet he understood what the old man had meant about the pain of choosing. He understood that all too well. Tyrion Lannister had claimed that most men would rather deny a hard truth than face it. But John was done with denials. He was who he was. John Snow, bastard, an oathbreaker, motherless, friendless, and damned. For the rest of his life, however long that might be, he would be condemned to be an outsider, the silent man standing in the shadows who dares not speak his true name. Wherever he might go throughout the Seven Kingdoms, he would need to live a lie, lest every man's hand be raised against him. But it made no matter, so long as he lived long enough to take his place by his brother's side and help avenge his father. He remembered Rob as he had last seen him, standing in the yard with snow melting in his auburn hair. John would have to come to him in secret, disguised. He tried to imagine the look on Rob's face when he revealed himself. His brother would shake his head and smile, and he'd say... He could not see the smile. Hard as he tried, he could not see it. He found himself thinking of the deserter his father had beheaded the day they found the direwolves. "You said the words," Lord Eddard had told him. "You took the vow before your brothers, before the old gods and the new." Desmond and Fat Tom had dragged the man to the stump. Bran's eyes had been wide as saucers, and John had to remind him to keep his pony in hand. He remembered the look on Father's face when Theon Greyjoy brought forth ice, the spray of blood on the snow, the way Theon had kicked the head when it came rolling at his feet. He wondered what Lord Eddard might have done if the deserter had been his brother Benjen instead of that ragged stranger. Would it have been any different? It must. Surely. and Rob would welcome him, for a certainty. He had to, or else. It did not bear thinking about. Pain throbbed deep in his fingers as he clutched the reins. John put his heels into his horse and broke into a gallop, racing down the King's Road, as if to outrun his doubts. John was not afraid of death, but he did not want to die like that, trussed and bound and beheaded like a common brigand. If he must perish, let it be with a sword in his hand, fighting his father's killers. He was no true Stark, had never been one, but he could die like one. Let them say that Eddard Stark had fathered 4 sons, not 3. Ghost kept pace with them for almost half a mile, red tongue lulling from his mouth. Man and horse alike lowered their heads as he asked the mare for more speed. The wolf slowed, stopped, watching, his eyes glowing red in the moonlight. He vanished behind, but John knew he would follow, at his own pace. Scattered lights flickered through the trees ahead of him, on both sides of the road. Mole's Town. A dog barked as he rode through, and he heard a mule's raucous hawk from the stable. But otherwise, the village was still. Here and there, the glow of hearth fires shone through shuttered windows, leaking between wooden slats, but only a few. Mole's Town was bigger than it seemed, but 3/4 of it was under the ground, in deep, warm cellars connected by a maze of tunnels. Even the whorehouse was down there. Nothing on the surface but a wooden shack no bigger than a privy with a red lantern hung above the door. On the wall he'd heard men call the whores buried treasures. He wondered whether any of his brothers in black were down there tonight, mining. That was oath-breaking too, yet no one seemed to care. Not until he was well beyond the village did John slow again. By then both he and the mare were damp with sweat. He dismounted, shivering, his burnt hand aching. A bank of melting snow lay under the trees, bright in the moonlight, water trickling off to form small, shallow pools. John squatted and brought his hands together, cupping the runoff between his fingers. The snow melt was icy cold. He drank and splashed some on his face until his cheeks tingled. His fingers were throbbing worse than they had in days, and his head was pounding too. "I am doing the right thing," he told himself, "so why do I feel so bad?" The horse was well lathered, so John took the lead and walked her for a while. The road was scarcely wide enough for 2 riders to pass abreast, its surface cut by tiny streams and littered with stone. That run had been truly stupid, an invitation to a broken neck. John wondered what had gotten into him. Was he in such a great rush to die? Off in the trees, the distant scream of some frightened animal made him look up. His mare whinnied nervously. Had his wolf found some prey? He cupped his hands around his mouth. "Ghost!" he shouted. "Ghost! To me!" The only answer was a rush of wings behind him as an owl took flight. Frowning, John continued on his way. He led the mare for 30 minutes until she was dry. Ghost did not appear. John wanted to mount up and ride again, but he was concerned about his missing wolf. "Ghost!" he called again. "Where are you? To me! Ghost!" Nothing in these woods could trouble a direwolf, even a half-grown direwolf, unless... No. Ghost was too smart to attack a bear, and if there was a wolf pack anywhere close, John would have surely heard them howling. He should eat, he decided. Food would settle his stomach and give Ghost a chance to catch up. There was no danger yet. Castle Black still slept. In his saddlebag he found a biscuit, a piece of cheese, a small withered brown apple. He'd brought salt beef as well, and a rasher of bacon he'd filched from the kitchens, but he would save the meat for the morrow. After it was gone, he'd need to hunt, and that would slow him. John sat under the trees and ate his biscuit and cheese while his mare grazed along the king's road. He kept the apple for long.